Hi everyone, welcome back to the Internet Report, where we uncover what's working and what's breaking on the internet, and why. This week we're diving into the fascinating world of subsea cables, exploring how important they are to the internet ecosystem, how decisions are made on where to place them, and the consequences of cable cuts. I'm Barry Collins, and I'm joined as usual by Mike Hicks, Principal Solutions Analyst at Cisco Thousand Eyes. We also have a special guest with us, Murray Burling, the Executive Director of Oceans and Environment at RPS. As always, we've included chapters in the episode description below, so you can skip ahead to the sections that are most interesting to you. And if you haven't already, we'd love you to take a moment to give us a follow over at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen. Let's get on with the show, and I started by asking Murray to tell us about his background and his role at RPS.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Look, I'm an executive director with RPS, and we're an international consultancy. We work on all manner of scale of projects, and really our job is to make the complex easy for our clients. And, you know, we span all sorts of sectors, you know, from resource, energy, urban development, large-scale infrastructure. So it's pretty diverse. And within RPS, I lead the Oceans and Environment team. And really what we're about is trying to gather all the critical information to support our clients that want to operate, develop projects, be it onshore or offshore. So again, diverse range of sectors that we support, you know, from ports to shipping to renewable energy to conventional energy, even, you know, government agencies with search and rescue programs and things like that. Yeah, it's a pretty diverse role, but at heart, I'm an oceanographer, and that's what I've spent all my career with, and majority of that time really trying to predict how things behave in the ocean and how the ocean behaves. And that might be, you know, anything from ships in the ocean to people lost at sea to things we put into the ocean on purpose, like wastewater or desalination discharges, things like that, right through to things that are spilt in the ocean accidentally, like oil and when people are lost at sea. So lots of different things that have really kept me very interested and busy through my career.
Today we're focusing on subsea cables. So tell us more about the cable landscape as you see it, and explain where the cables are and how we decide where to put them.
Yeah, look, subsea cable network globally is really quite fascinating, and it's kind of under the radar of most people, really. A lot of people are just completely unaware of the extent and the importance of the subsea cable network. And if we look at it globally, there's hundreds of these cables, and they're, you know, really traversing almost all of the world's oceans and seas. And they carry almost all of the international and intercontinental communication traffic. So, you know, super important. If you look at a map of the world, it looks like someone's overturned a plate of spaghetti. You know, it does look like they're all over the place, but we're obviously trying to connect place to place, point to point. And there's a lot of density across the sort of the main connectivity routes, you know, like the North Atlantic, North Pacific, around the continental coastal margins. And then some pretty complex networks, you know, through Southeast Asia, the Caribbean and other sort of, you know, island areas. So it is quite fascinating. And, you know, the scale of them is also interesting. You know, you can have relatively short cables, which might be 100 or 200 kilometres long, but you can go right up to, I think the longest one now is the newly commissioned to Africa one, which is about 45,000 kilometres. So it's pretty hard to get your head around that sort of number, but they're big, they're small, they're windy, they're all over the place, and, you know, there's a lot of them.
When you're dealing with cables of such extraordinary length, presumably you need some kind of repeaters to maintain the signal strength.
My understanding is that, you know, there's a few different types of repeaters. It depends on the technology. And obviously the technology is getting a lot more advanced every time they lay a cable. If you go way, way, way back to the very first ones in the 1850s, they were put out there as a single line. You know, they quickly found out that they couldn't operate super well because of the losses in the transmission. And I think the very first one, they tried to up the voltage they put through it and just blew the thing up. So, you know, so it's really interesting. These long cable spans, they need to repeat the signal, and they do it in all sorts of different ways. I did have a look at some of the modern cable technology, and it's well beyond me in terms of the physics involved. Yeah,
it's an interesting point though, because I think you've just said something there, and I actually probably laid that first cable. I'm that old, but we've actually progressed around from copper circuits, where the original ones were telegraph circuits, and that's what they carried. They were carrying telegraphs. These existed for a long time. but now we're into the fiber optics. And that becomes relevant. Obviously, we can't improve on the speed of light, but what we can do is we can actually change the optical waves. So, you know, all of a sudden, this fiber cable we have there, we can split the density or split the wavelengths to effectively give it more capacity. This is actually exactly what we've seen in some instances where there has been damage to some of these cables.
Yeah, and I think, look, capacity is the big thing, isn't it? It's like the hunger for bandwidth in the world is insatiable, right? So trying to expand on the bandwidth and going back to that first cable story, seemed like the bandwidth of that cable was 3 words a minute. So if you think about that, it's quite phenomenal where we've come.
That's the rate I speak at.
So when you look at the current subsea cable industry, what trends do you see?
What we're seeing is that there's still an ongoing appetite and process for laying more cables. We're seeing that all manner of organisations, governments, private companies, they are really investing in resilience, they're investing in capacity, and so projects are continuing. But we're also seeing, you know, in the offshore space, there's an increasing competition for space. There's increasing activity. The level of potential project conflict is increasing in terms of the areas that you can use. And with that, ultimately, might be an increase in the potential risk of incidents and potential for cable failures and things like that, just because of the sheer volume of activity in the nearshore margins. And one example of that is the big responses to the need to transition our energy sources is to be building offshore wind farms. So we're looking at installing turbines in the near coastal environment that turn the wind into power, which, by the way, obviously are connected by cables to the land. But these wind farms, they take up a big chunk of space, often in areas that are in zones where you might be looking to put subsea cables through and those kind of things. So you've got a tremendous amount of increased activity just in that one little sector. So that's another trend that we're seeing. You know, the complexity of getting approvals for these projects is increasing just by virtue of industry escalation.
You've mentioned something there, Murray, where, you know, we talked about the submarine landing zones. So where we come into a shallow water area near coastal, I think you've referred to it as there. You know, this is where we frequently see the most damage, where we see ships drag their anchors for these submarine zones. But it's interesting, I haven't considered these other options, you say, where we're taking in the wind farms and things like that and all sorts of activity. What other areas do we see damage occurring? Is we more likely to see it in the deep sea or are we more likely to see it in that landing zone?
In terms of where the damage occurs, I think it just really depends on what's driving the damage. And but I think you're right. Certainly in the near shore, that's the zone where you're more likely to have ships at anchor. And when ships are at anchor, they're dropping anchors. They could be moved by storms. They could be adrift. They could drag their anchors along the bottom. And all of a sudden, you might have a situation that intersects a cable and you have a cable breakage. So those nearshore environments are where the cables are probably most vulnerable. And certainly looking ahead, one of the things with climate change that we're seeing is that with rising sea levels and increasing storm intensity, that a lot of the coastlines around the world are at risk of recession. So what that means is that during big storms or even in the long term, that the coastal margin is retreating. And so with a lot of these landfall areas where the cables are coming ashore, without any intervention, they'll be potentially subject to more risk. And, you know, and that's an environmental style risk as opposed to a man-made sort of conflict, usage conflict, if you like. Aside from those, you know, some of the other ways that the cables might break could be due to, you know, extreme events like earthquakes, for example. And while we can't predict them, we can be fairly, at least we understand where the most active seismic zones, for example, around the oceans are. And so have more understanding and more ability to be ready for those kind of breakages. But they tend to be much more catastrophic.
Right. And that's the type of planning you're looking at. So you know where these areas are, and this we're looking at the weather patterns and things like that.
Yeah, well, that would be all part of the consideration. So, you know, I think, Barry, you asked, you know, right at the top, what influences where these cables might go? So you might start with a notion that I've got to go from point A to point B to connect this country and that country, for example. But by the time you start looking at it, you might need to change those endpoints because you might need to avoid areas of excessive seismic activity, for example. It's just higher risk. Or you might need to avoid areas of high marine conservation value, for example. So you don't want to come out from one area of the coast when potentially, well, we should go from another centre because there's a lower protection level associated with it, for example. So there's all sorts of reasons that drive you know, where these cables might want to be. But of course, the people that are funding these projects, you know, they're looking for the lowest cost. So the lowest cost is point A to point B in the shortest possible distance. So it's obviously a key driver and a strong influence of the planning on these things.
And there's also considerations, you know, obviously the cost comes in for the point A to point B, but you mentioned the bandwidth type of thing. We are dealing with fibers here and we are restricted by the speed of light. So we always talk about bandwidth and uploads and download speeds and that type of capacities, but realistically, we also have to be considerate of performance. So therefore, we are also tied to this latency that we're going to get. And there's no way, as I said, I can improve on the speed of light, although I think they thought they had down at CERN a few years back, but but it's, you know, we can't do that. So, you know, packet passing point A to packet going to point B is going to be dependent on the geography of it. You know, the shortest path wherever possible in the best opportune manner, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing beats the shortest cable for cost and performance. But, you know, there's obviously a whole host of things that also go into it. You've got your whole geopolitical security aspects. You know, where do you put your cable through certain areas? You've got general geotechnical conditions, all sorts of conditions related to where you want to put the cable. You're obviously also looking to install the cable where possible into areas that you can easily then maintain the cable when you do have a problem. Because, you know, in some cases, cables can be laid in water that's so deep, it's really difficult to actually repair.
We talked about how easy it is to damage these enormous subsea cables. How do you go about fixing one?
Yeah, well, I think the first challenge you've got is to figure out where the damage is, you know, and I think that sometimes that's probably easier than other times. If you think about some of these cables that are 45,000 kilometres long, you know, there's a bit of work to do to work out where the damage is. So the ability to repair and the time it takes to repair will then depend on where and what the damage is.
And is that a process of literally having to physically inspect the cable, or are there ways to tell where the damage is without having to send out ships?
They use light, basically. We talked about them being optical cables. So you can effectively look for refraction as you're going down. So they basically bounce a signal and wait for it to break. But it is an iterative process as they go down these 45,000 kilometer paths to find where that issue is. The other consideration is they actually have to pull these cables up. They obviously need a vessel to be able to do this. So there's not that many vessels capable of actually repairing these cables as they're out there. So you've got to wait for one to be in the area. You've got to wait for it not to be in use. And this essentially comes back also to the consortiums, because then who actually owns these cables in the first place? You know, these aren't cheap things to put down. So typically what you see is you see them sort of laid, or a whole consortium will go into it, made up of many companies, might be government organizations, might be collections of governments. And some of the hyperscales, obviously, there will be on consortiums, but also putting their own cables down there. Now, there will be then preferences about which cable sort of gets fixed first, bearing in mind sort of how big they are, how important they are, or who actually owns the cable repairer. Relevant might be someone in the consortium that actually owns that cable repair ship that is in the area. So you have to wait for another cable repair ship. So this sort of all leads on to the time it takes to repair it. But once they get to it, it's literally a case of we found where this break is or this damage is. And typically it's damage rather than sort of a break. So it's a broken fiber in the middle there, or it's crunched, and this is where we see that issue taking place. Then they literally pull it up and resplice it and then drop it back down again. That's, you know, obviously time it takes to locate the issue is the biggest part.
Yeah, and of course, when they locate it, they've got to get there with a vessel that's got to be available, as you said, Mike, and they've got to be able to operate when they get there as well. So you can imagine a scenario where there's been a break in an area where there's severe weather for a prolonged period, and it's just not feasible for the vessel to be out there and operating. So those are the kind of things where obviously planning is important and response can be really dependent on conditions at the time.
It's a good point. I mean, the fact we've had an issue there caused by seismic activity or caused by a big storm. There is a myth that sharks eat these cables, but I think there's few and far between. But it is normally caused by some sort of extreme damage in the deep water. As we said, in the shallow water, easier to locate. If there's this storm going on at the moment, we can't actually get a vessel out. Even if one's available, we have to wait before it can go there.
And Mike, you know, you talked about, you know, unlikely sharks are a problem, but I wouldn't be so sure. We find with a lot of our oceanographic equipment that octopus, they absolutely love the rubber that goes out on a lot of our oceanographic equipment. So in the marine environment, we're often faced with challenges of trying to de-rubber the rubber as it were, so the octopus don't pull our equipment apart and cause us to lose valuable information that we're out there collecting. So, you know, there's the marine environment and the things that live in it, they're pretty unpredictable at times.
That's very cool, actually. I never thought about that. I had a situation with terrestrial cables where the rats were eating the outside of my fiber cables, but I never considered it the octopus doing this. So that's actually very interesting.
So assuming we're not talking about octopus nibbles, are most cable repairs a lengthy process?
Yeah, definitely. Weeks. It's weeks, sometimes into months.
And so presumably that can have a major impact on an area's connectivity if a cable is out for a long period of time.
Yes and no. I mean, it obviously depends where that damage is. So if we're thinking again in the local area, if we're hitting that stub coming in and we're looking for a big feed coming in, as we sort of saw within the cable cuts we saw on the east and west coast of Africa, the biggest impact of that was on the local area, so on the African countries itself. They had to find sort of diverse ways to actually take it because of where the damage was occurring there and where the service they're trying to access was. Because that's the other thing, you know, we're connecting to other services out of region effectively when we see these. Now, I say yes and no because Murray mentioned up the top, if you look at this map over the top of where the submarine cables go, it's a huge spaghetti of cables on top there. There's an awful lot of bandwidth availability, or a lot of capacity, I should say, out there. So what you find is it's easy, and we talked about the optical switching, to sort of switch paths. Now, what you might then see is an increase in latency because we're taking the shortest path, but effectively you still get that connectivity. And then there's other alternate ways you can actually get through. But it depends on sort of damage. I mean, you get these situations where we have sort of extreme weather conditions and where a particular location is fed by one single connection. I think Tonga was an example where we had something like that. And at that point, then the complete location is cut off. But in reality, if we're talking about somewhere where it has multiple cables, there's you know, typically three or four landing points as you go across countries, there's different ways to get in there and different capacity that can take place.
As we talked about earlier in the show, route diversity of subsea internet cables has vastly improved the internet's resilience. Do you think subsea cables will continue to offer such resilience, or are we looking to other technologies?
Various figures have come out talking sort of 97-99% of the internet traffic will flow through these subsea cables. And again, as Murray said, that you look at this vast diversity of cables we have, obviously want to take the most optimal path. So you've got to think of where the services are. But again, I'll come back to that East Africa, West Africa issue where we had there. And I still hold up Microsoft as a beautiful example of something that went right. They operate a 4-to-1 ratio in terms of redundancy up and down those paths. And they had four capacity on four circuits, two on the east, two on the west, which meant they could actually lose three of these and still have no issues or no capacity issues going on there. The unfortunate thing as this happens is they had an optical failure on one of the line cards at the same time, which took them down to 3.5. But even then, they were able to sort of switch circuits or switch frequencies or wavelengths was what I was desperately searching for there to be able to increase capacity. And they took some stuff up country. Now, building on that as well is, you know, we're talking about this vast amount of traffic going through the subsea cables, and it does that from a speed perspective. But you also have different ways of getting into different countries and different aspects from there. We're from Australia. We have some very remote stuff. We will use satellite into some areas. Certainly the way it is at the moment, if we consider all the satellites that are up there from a LEO perspective or even the geostationary ones, they don't have the capacity specifically to take the whole of the internet. But what they can actually do is to supplement those. So you have this resilience not only within the backbone of the subsea cables themselves, but in certain areas where we can actually sort of hop around using the satellites. Now the one caveat I will say to that is those satellites will also rely on those subsea cables for their backhaul. So it's just a way sometimes of getting up country or getting from one area to another.
Murray, do you agree the subsea cables will provide the bulk of international connectivity for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple at the moment, Barry, in that subsea cables are currently carrying, 99% of traffic or something like that. It's a huge proportion at the moment. So they're vital for our connectivity and the resilience. And I can't see that changing going forward. They're going to be increasingly more critical as their capacity demands continue. I think I said earlier, you know, the world's got an insatiable demand for capacity at the moment. So it's only ever increasing. And I think also more than that, connectivity is going to be super important for the developing world and making sure that we're allowing connectivity and connection and the opportunity for, you know, improved education, improved health system, improved business growth in the developing world as well. Because I think the developed world, I think we take the internet for granted these days. And we certainly don't think about the huge network of undersea cables that are essentially underpinning the resilience and the information flow. So we all know what it's like when the internet goes down at home. You know, we're all wondering how we're going to do our job and how we're going to watch our favourite show and how we're going to check if Arsenal won overnight. It's something we take for granted and something we can't do without. And I think underwater cables are just critical for the infrastructure going forward.
I think it's you're right there. We often forget about this. I call it digital equity, and I realize that means different things to different people. When I talk about digital equity, I'm talking about the ability to have access to internet at the same speed and the same applications, irrespective of where you are. Again, if you have a single point of connection into a location or a remote location, both you and I suffer from this. We're not too far from the CBD, but apparently we're actually in the outback. So, you know, the type of connectivity you can actually get is restricted. But also then I think we got to consider the characteristics of the applications themselves. So there's things that you can do. So, you know, we don't necessarily have to backhaul everything across the world. So although you're absolutely 100% correct, this capacity and this demand for capacity is going to increase. But if we think about how the applications themselves can be architected, you know, we can have sort of more points. So we can use CDNs to reduce that latency at the edges, and then we can just have sort of backhaul updates. And once we start to do things like that, we change we don't change the characteristics, but we design for the characteristics of the application. And then we can supplement it. So if you think of a streaming service going in there, although it's not good to watch the soccer over a streaming service, I tell you, because I'll get updates before I've actually seen it on the screen. but the point is that is very much a download medium. So I don't need high upload speeds. Doesn't matter about latency, because I've got playback buffers and jitter buffers, which can actually cope with that on my end devices. So it doesn't matter. So therefore, I don't need to travel that essentially the speed of light. I can take that and I can use and leverage a LEO network to do that. It's a brilliant medium for actually doing that. So as we start to go, and I think we're starting to see this, is we're starting to see the applications match the business requirements or the personal requirements in terms of getting that streaming from a performance perspective and designed around it. But as you say, at the back of all of that is this subsea cable system which supports it.
That's our show. Huge thanks to Murray Burling for joining us this week. Please like and subscribe. We really appreciate it. And not only does this ensure you're in the know when a new episode's published, it also helps us to shape the show for you. You can follow us on X at Thousand Eyes or send questions and feedback to internetreport@thousandeyes.com. Until next time, goodbye.